Are you improving outcomes with SpHb? Continuous SpHb monitoring provides real-time visibility to changes or lack of changes in hemoglobin concentration between invasive blood draws and has been shown in multiple studies to help clinicians improve outcomes. Visit Masimo.com to learn more.
Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the April 2021 issue, as selected by the journal editors. This month's issue contains two articles and an editorial on the topic of opioid-free anesthesia. There has been increasing discussion about this approach to perioperative care. We bring some trusted evidence to the discussion. Our first article this month examines the topic of opioid-free anesthesia. It reports on a randomized clinical trial that investigated whether opioid-free anesthesia affects the frequency of postoperative adverse events. Dr. Helene Beaulieu of the University of Rennes and colleagues elsewhere in France conducted the study, which is known as the POFA trial, or P-O-F-A. They compared opioid-free balanced anesthesia using dexmedetomidine versus balanced anesthesia with remifentanil and morphine. They tested the hypothesis that opioid-free anesthesia would result in fewer postoperative opioid-related adverse events. The primary outcome was a composite of opioid-related adverse events within the first 48 hours after extubation. These events included hypoxemia, ileus, or cognitive dysfunction. The authors found that postoperative hypoxemia occurred significantly more in the opioid-free dexmedetomidine group compared to the opioid group. There were no differences in ileus or cognitive dysfunction. The main secondary outcomes were postoperative pain and opioid consumption and postoperative nausea and vomiting. Both postoperative opioid consumption and postoperative nausea and vomiting were less in the dexmedetomidine group, but analgesia did not differ. The dexmedetomidine patients, however, did have delayed extubation and prolonged stay in the postoperative care unit. But the most striking result of the investigation was the incidence of unanticipated severe adverse events. There were 5 cases of severe bradycardia in the dexmedetomidine group, including 3 cases of asystole. The study was stopped early because of safety concerns with the dexmedetomidine group. The POFA trial refuted the hypothesis that balanced opioid-free anesthesia with dexmedetomidine would result in fewer postoperative opioid-related adverse events compared to balanced anesthesia with remifentanil. Our next clinical study pertains to regional anesthesia. It was a dose-finding exploration to define the optimal volume of 0.5% ropivacaine needed for a successful ultrasound-guided costoclavicular block for surgical anesthesia. Dr. Anu Kulani and colleagues at the Postgraduate Institute of Medical Education and Research in Chandigarh, India, conducted this study. Their objective was to determine the median effective dose of 0.5% ropivacaine, that is, what was the volume of ropivacaine required for surgical anesthesia in 50% of the patients they evaluated. They also wanted to determine the calculated dose required for effective blockade in 95% of patients. This was a prospective, single-arm study which enrolled adults who were scheduled to undergo forearm and hand surgeries under ultrasound-guided costoclavicular block. The extent of sensory and motor block were assessed in the median, radial, and ulnar and musculocutaneous nerve distributions, and they were graded using 3-point scales. After a successful or unsuccessful block, the volume of local anesthetic was correspondingly decreased or increased by 2 mL in the next patient. The authors considered anesthesia to be successful if the surgeon was able to proceed with surgery without needing to supplement anesthesia. Among 38 patients, the volume of local anesthetic administered ranged from 8 mL to 26 mL, but the authors concluded that the median effective dose of 0.5% ropivacaine was 14 cc's, and that 19 cc's was likely to produce an effective ultrasound-guided costoclavicular block for providing adequate surgical anesthesia in 95% of patients. Our next study was a database evaluation to assess whether one lung ventilation using a lung protective approach would affect patient outcomes after major surgery. Dr. Douglas Cahoon of the University of Michigan and colleagues there and elsewhere conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that a one lung protective ventilation regimen would be independently associated with lesser odds of pulmonary complications after thoracic surgery. They defined one lung protective ventilation as the combination of two criteria. These were median tidal volumes less than 5 mL per kilo of predicted body weight and positive end expiratory pressures greater than 5 centimeters of water. The authors used data from two databases for 3,200 lung resection procedures using one lung ventilation across five institutions. The primary outcome was a composite of 30-day major postoperative pulmonary complications. Pulmonary complications were one or more of the following: initial ventilator support greater than 48 hours, reintubation, pneumonia, atelectasis requiring bronchoscopy, ARDS, air leak for more than 5 days, a bronchopleurofistula, respiratory failure, tracheostomy, pulmonary embolism, or empyema requiring treatment. The authors found that during the study period, from 2012 to 2016, there was an overall decrease in tidal volume. In addition, positive end expiratory pressure increased from 4 to 5 centimeters of water. And protective lung ventilation strategy was increasingly used during this study period, 6% of patients in 2012 compared to 18% in 2016. The main finding of the investigation was that despite this increase in the use of lung protective ventilation, there was no change in the prevalence of postoperative pulmonary complications. And the authors concluded that using a low tidal volume lung protective ventilation regimen or modified airway driving pressure during one lung ventilation was not associated with the odds of major postoperative pulmonary complications. Next, we have a retrospective cohort study that looked at the association between preoperative frailty and postoperative complications and mortality. We know that moderate to severe complications are common after major surgery and can have substantial impact on long-term volumes. We also know that postoperative complications and mortality are strongly associated with preoperative frailty. But we do not understand well the relationship between frailty and postoperative complications and mortality. Dr. Daniel McIsaac and colleagues at the University of Ottawa in Canada conducted this retrospective study to examine that relationship. They tested the hypothesis that a substantial proportion of the total effect of frailty on mortality after elective non-cardiac surgery would be mediated by postoperative complications. They used data from the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program to estimate the total effect of frailty on mortality. They also estimated the proportion of the frailty-mortality association that appeared to be mediated by complications. Out of 200,000 intermediate risk to high risk patients, about 10% developed complications. Complications mediated slightly more than half, 57%, of the association between frailty and postoperative mortality. Cardiopulmonary complications were more likely to contribute to this association than either renal or infectious complications. And the authors concluded that half of the association of frailty with postoperative mortality appears to be mediated by the occurrence of postoperative complications, but also that a substantial proportion may be related to non-complicated mediated mechanisms as well. Next, we have another retrospective cohort study. This one examined complications after surgery. It asked whether the risk of cardiac-related complications after cardiac surgery differed between cases performed in the morning or in the afternoon. Dr. Ryan Hijazi and colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic conducted this single-center study. They analyzed the data from three common types of cardiac surgery performed at their institution during an 8-year period, from 2011 to 2018, specifically aortic and/or mitral valve repair or replacement and coronary artery bypass grafting. They devised a composite outcome of in-hospital mortality and low cardiac output syndrome. They compared the composite outcome of patients who had surgery in the morning to those who had surgery in the afternoon. Among 9,700 surgeries, the composite of in-hospital mortality and low cardiac output syndrome occurred in 2.8% of the morning surgery patients and 3.4% of the afternoon surgery patients. This was not a statistically significant difference. There were also no differences between morning and afternoon surgery in the various surgical subgroups. And the authors concluded that patients who had cardiac surgery with aortic cross clamping in the morning or afternoon did not have significantly different outcomes. And they found no evidence to suggest that morning or afternoon surgical timing alters postoperative risk. Our next article reports on a laboratory study. This study was designed to assess the role of acetylcholine in the effects of general anesthetics, isoflurane, and ketamine. Dr. L. Stan Leung and colleagues at the University of Western Ontario conducted this study. They tested the hypothesis that mice with genetic deficiency of forebrain acetylcholine would show increased anesthetic sensitivity to isoflurane and ketamine. The authors also wanted to determine whether these mice would also show decreased brain electroencephalogram, or EEG, activity. They compared wild-type mice with two experimental models of mice. One of these models had heterozygous knockdown of the vesicular acetylcholine transporter in the brain, and the other type had homozygous knockout of the transporter in the basal forebrain. The authors administered various doses of isoflurane and ketamine, and they determined the dose that was needed to achieve anesthesia or unconsciousness, which they defined as the loss of writing reflex. In genetic modified mice lacking the vesicular acetylcholine transporter in the forebrain, lower doses of isoflurane and ketamine were necessary to induce the loss of writing reflex compared to the wild-type counterparts. But no differences were observed in mice with the knockdown of the acetylcholine transporter in the brain. EEG gamma activity in the hippocampus after isoflurane or ketamine was lower in both the knockout and the knockdown mice compared to wild-type mice. But EEG gamma activity in the frontal cortex with either isoflurane or ketamine was not different between the knockout, the knockdown, or the wild-type mice. The authors concluded that cholinergic neurons in the forebrain modulate anesthetic sensitivity during both isoflurane and ketamine anesthesia. Our clinical focus review article this month focuses on the management of patient-ventilator asynchrony. This is sometimes referred to as a patient fighting the ventilator. Dr. James Bailey of Northeast Georgia Physicians Group in the Northeast Georgia Health System in Gainesville, Georgia, authored this review. Patient ventilator asynchrony reflects a mismatch between patient demand for flow, volume, or pressure, and what the ventilator is delivering. Asynchrony can impede adequate oxygenation and ventilation, and it may also reflect patient distress and discomfort. When asynchrony happens, clinicians are obligated to find methods to reduce patient distress. The review details the need to first understand the reason for the asynchrony and, second, how to correct it as a component of patient management. Asynchrony can be corrected by understanding the nature of the patient demand ventilator delivery mismatch and then adjusting the ventilator mode and settings. However, patient ventilator asynchrony is commonly addressed by increasing the depth of patient sedation or using a neuromuscular blocking drug. However, this can have unintended consequences. Specifically, deeper sedation is associated with increasing length of stay and mortality, and the use of neuromuscular blocking drugs has been specifically associated with severe weakness and critical illness myopathy. And these can make weaning the patient from mechanical ventilation very difficult. The article advocates for first analyzing the nature of the patient demand ventilator delivery mismatch and then adjusting the ventilator accordingly. This approach may facilitate management of the spontaneously ventilating patient in both critical care and the operating room. Anesthesiologists can expect a variety of monitoring trends to help combat patient ventilator asynchrony in the future. In addition, new ventilator modes are being investigated that may improve our ability to both detect and prevent asynchronies. Modes under investigation include assist ventilation and neurally adjusted ventilator assist. And I'll close this month with a return to our opening topic, opioid-free anesthesia. Specifically, a review article that provides a critical look at opioid-free compared to opioid-sparing approaches to anesthesia and analgesia. Dr. Harsha Shanthana of McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and colleagues elsewhere wrote this review. They report that opioid-free strategies, however noble their cause, do not fully acknowledge the limitations and gaps within existing evidence and clinical practice considerations. Opioid-free strategies do not allow analgesic titration based on patient needs. No clinical consensus has yet been reached about optimal components of opioid-free regimens and their role in different settings and phases of care. Opioid-free strategies do not allow analgesic titration based on patient needs, nor do they decrease the risk of persistent postoperative opioid use. There is no evidence that opioid-free strategies have benefits beyond those of opioid-sparing strategies. And the focus on opioid-free anesthesia distracts anesthesiologists from alleviating pain and minimizing realistic long-term harms. various safe and feasible opioid-based options can be successfully adapted to individual patient needs. The authors of this review advocate for a clinical framework that involves patient education, preoperative opioid minimization, use of multimodal analgesic strategies, and postoperative analgesia titrated to transitional pain needs. This multi-pronged approach can successfully decrease the risk of persistent opioid use and persistent post-surgical pain. As always, I thank you for your interest in and your support of our journal. I hope you will use the information that's published in Anesthesiology to guide and improve your clinical practice. And I look forward to keeping you informed as Anesthesiology continues to publish important research and trusted evidence each month.
Are you improving outcomes with SpHb? Continuous SpHb monitoring provides real-time visibility to changes or lack of changes in hemoglobin concentration between invasive blood draws and has been shown in multiple studies to help clinicians improve outcomes. Visit Masimo.com to learn more.